Loyal listeners, what elevates a cup of coffee from being good to being the best? Well, something's telling me it might be fresh. Fresh roasted beans. But truly, fresh roasted coffee is harder to come by than you think. Most coffee you get from shops or your local grocery store is roasted months before it gets to the shelves. But not to worry. Sparkplug Coffee has solved this problem for you. Sparkplug doesn't roast your coffee until you order it, then immediately delivers it right to your door anywhere in Canada, so that it's always fresh and at peak flavor. Sparkplug has lots of varieties to suit any taste, and they offer regular set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you'll never run out of coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
It's way past time.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello and thanks for tuning in to the Top 105 Project, the podcast that takes a look back at the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. If you're not up to speed on Tootsie, careful, because we have our spoiler hats on. I am Ryan Ellis with that actress, that character actress, my wife Bev.
That's me.
The coming attractions trivia for this week's film, Tootsie, which was an enormous hit, the 66th biggest ever, adjusted for inflation, on Box Office Mojo's Top 200. What are the other four Dustin Hoffman movies, AFI or not, on Box Office Mojo's Top 200 list? And if you can do those in order, that's even more impressive.
Oh, God, I can't even think of one that I would imagine would be on the list.
What's his biggest hit? We've already covered it.
Oh.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
Oh, The Graduate? Oh, yeah. I forgot that was such
a big hit.
Monster
hit, yeah. No other AFI films. His other two did not make it. All the President's Men and Midnight Cowboy failed to do that. So I'll give them now because you're not getting them. Best Picture, though. Two are Best Picture winners.
Rain Man?
Yes, that is one of them. It won Best Picture also.
Oh, it did.
Kramer versus Kramer. And here's the one you probably wouldn't have gotten even if you'd really put some work into this, but you didn't. Meet the Fockers.
Oh, of course.
Was huge. It was a monster hit.
I probably would have guessed that before I guessed that Kramer versus Kramer was on Box Office Mojo.
Rain Man and KBK were very close together, in fact. People love those movies.
Wow.
Okay, the Top 100 Project's 105th movie, Tootsie, was 62nd on AFI's 1998 Top 100. Between Vertigo and Stagecoach, then moved down an unlucky seven spots to 69th in 2007 between Unforgiven and A Clockwork Orange. After a premiere on December 1st, 1982, Tootsie's dominance at the box office began on December 17th. Bev will describe this film for you with this game.
Dustin Hoffman is Michael Dorsey, a difficult but desperate New York actor who decides to dress as a woman to land a gig on a soap opera. He falls for co-star Julie Nichols, played by Jessica Lange, while her father, played by Charles Durning, falls for Michael. All while he's dressed as his alter ego, Dorothy. Hijinks!
Hilarious hijinks. 30s-esque hijinks. Or, in a nutshell, con man risks job by improvising during live broadcast. Okay, we've talked about how big a hit this movie was, so let's talk more about those numbers. But first, the critics. 88% of Rotten Tomatoes critics are big fans, 38 fresh, 5 rotten, 81% of audiences. But here are the box office numbers. We said 66th on Mojo, and that was $450 million worth, incidentally, which is more than West Side Story, Rocky, or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, adjusted for inflation.
Wow.
We think of those as monster hits. Tootsie, even bigger than them. And it was second at the 1982 U.S. box office. We covered number one already. And it blew it out the water. It was E.T.
Yeah.
But even this blew out everything else. One more thing I want to say about the year 1982, when we cover four AFI films, by far the most in the 80s, it was a big year for drag. This was also the year of Victor Victoria, with Julie Andrews and Robert Preston, each dressing as the opposite sex, and The World According to Garp, an Academy Award nominee with John Lithgow, dressed as a woman. But that's just a gimmick to hang the clothes on this movie, pun intended, I guess. Dustin Hoffman maybe living out his life on screen a little bit, apart from the dressing as a woman thing. But enough out of me. What do you think about Tootsie?
Meh. It's not without its charms. It's very palatable and entertaining. Its politics are painfully anachronistic, and I just don't think it's funny enough to merit all this praise. Obviously, it struck a nerve in 82, but I think it's only on the list because it's a film about actors, and so many of the voters are probably actors. This has not held up to the test of time.
I'm with you on that. We weren't big fans of The Graduate either.
No.
And The Midnight Cowboy even was not as great now. No, that's true. Maybe it wasn't even as great then, but we didn't think that was quite the film that people thought in 1969, the Best Picture winner of 1969. All the President's Men may have gotten better. It's also not so much about him. It's more about Redford. And I've said on this podcast so many times that I think the best actor as far as range in his generation, as good as that generation has been, Nicholson and Hackman and Beatty and all those great guys, that Dustin Hoffman is probably as good as any of them. Those guys have played themselves on screen so often. He has sometimes done that, but generally he takes on different kinds of characters. The young adult trying to find himself in The Graduate, the dirty bum and Midnight Cowboy, and a drifter kind of character, a con man. I said con man a minute ago for this movie. The journalist and All the President's Men, now an actor. That's quite a good range there. His performance is very good, but the movie, I agree, does not hold up. And I don't think the movie's really all that funny, despite maybe 6 or 8 really good laughs. And don't forget, we usually cover this at the end, number 2 on the AFI's Top 100 Laughs list. But it's behind Some Like It Hot, also about cross-dressing.
Why is it about cross-dressing? Okay, I'm going to dispute your opinion. I think that Dustin Hoffman's a great actor, but I don't think that this is a great performance. His affectations as a woman are complete overkill, to the point where you take something that's bordering on authentic and you just make it hard to believe, because it's not like his performance as a woman is funny the way that Jack Lemmon's performance as a woman is funny in Some Like It Hot, but it's also not believable.
You don't think they'd fall for his shtick then?
No. Well, they might believe that he's a woman, but he wouldn't become besties with the star of the show. He wouldn't make men fall in love with him. To take it that far was just, I don't know, it was just too far. And I don't think he's that funny. I mean, I've liked him in other comedic roles. I thought, actually, Meet the Fockers, which is a dumb movie.
He's
probably him and Barbara Streisand are the best things about that movie. Yep. Absolutely. Yep. And I love him in Stranger Than Fiction, which is one of my favorite modern comedies.
Wag the Dog,
yeah.
This is nothing.
Yeah, he can be funny. He's definitely not the funniest thing in Tootsie. Terry Garr is doing circles around him as far as just stealing scenes, or Bill Murray, talk about scene stealers. It's just not my favorite Dustin Hoffman performance by any measure.
So we're saying right off the bat that we don't think this movie qualifies in almost any way. Although there are criteria, yes it does. It was a huge hit, it won some awards, and a lot of people would say it's influential and it's held up. We're saying the most important parts of those things are, do you actually like the movie still? Which we didn't really.
I mean, I liked it. But is it...
Well, liked it through the eyes of an AFI Top 100.
Then no, absolutely not.
All right, we won't have to repeat that at the end then. A thumbs down for that part of it
being an AFI film. Yeah.
I always remembered Mel Brooks on the AFI special. When they got to Tootsie, before they even said it was Tootsie in the 62nd spot, he said, AFI, where are your comedies? And then they show this movie. If they're going to use him saying that, put it before one of the actually truly funny movies.
Well, you've said this many times before. Their comedies list is among their worst lists. They have, I don't know, some antiquated, weird sense of humor. But what they like in terms of comedies is so strange and absurd to me. And to call this number 2? Come on. Picking movies from the 80s, if you're going to pick it just because it's a crowd pleaser, just because it's funny because it made you laugh at the time, pick Ghostbusters. That is not just a plain funnier movie and way more entertaining movie, but as far as its cultural impact, people love Ghostbusters way more now than they care about Tootsie.
That's a movie that gets referenced in the Chris Hardwick podcast, The Nerdist, quite a bit. He's a big fan of that one. And he's a nerd, admittedly. He's not going to mention Tootsie in his podcast very often. But that's a good point you're making, because there's a guy who's influencing culture in a big way. He's become a huge player, and that's one of his favorite movies from the 80s.
And he's not alone. Ghostbusters should be on the list, period. It should definitely... Is it? It must be on the last list.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get to the origin of the story. It's been said that Dustin Hoffman, having to play both a mother and a father in Kramer vs. Kramer, which was 3 years before this movie, was the reason why he wanted to do this kind of character. And I guess he wanted the acting challenge of, can I pull this off? He knew he's not an attractive man. He's no cake-looking guy, I guess. But then he's got the big nose. That doesn't help. But can I pass as a woman? All right, let's get to the real heart of this thing. And that is the AFI special. I'll mention it again. When they talked about Tootsie, it's one of the longer sequences for a movie that's not near the top 10. For those who've never seen the AFI Top 100 shows, number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, the most is said about them, especially number 1. If you're 62nd, or if you're 73rd, or if you're 100, you're barely mentioned. They'll show one little clip of you and have one person saying, I like that movie, I saw it when I was 3, or something like that. But Tootsie has a big sequence where Dustin Hoffman starts crying on camera. Yeah. It's very touching. I hope I can find it on YouTube. I'm sure it's out there, and I'll put it on the site.
If you've never seen the special, or if you've ever seen any of the special, you've seen this clip, because it's gone viral several times mm-hmm. over. It kind of keeps making the rounds on the internet. People keep reintroducing it. That's really rather sweet and moving mm-hmm. when he talks about what it was like to experience empathy from a female point of view.
Because he was saying that he would not talk to a woman who looked like Dorothy mm-hmm. at a party. And his wife at the time said, why? And he said, she doesn't fit the physical needs. In other words, she isn't hot enough. Mm-hmm. And then as he was doing the movie, and he looked like this woman that he wouldn't have talked to, and this is where he starts breaking down the special, he says, there's so many conversations with interesting people I've not had because of my own bias.
Because he said he was brainwashed.
Yes, I'm misquoting him here, but that's the gist of it. And he also says at the end of it, that was never a comedy for me. And then they go to the commercial break at that point. And it's one of the most touching moments in the whole thing. Sidney Pollack, the director, talks about how they didn't play it as a comedy on set. Most of the best comedies are not played mm-hmm. that way. Because if the actors play it straight and the script is good and it's edited the right way, then it's going to come across as funny if it's supposed to be funny.
Comedy is commitment.
And good writing.
Sure,
and I think this movie has the good writing. I mentioned editing a second ago. I've never been a fan, I've seen the movie 3 times now, of the way they cut on their stinger lines. Maybe 5 times in the movie there'll be a line that's said and they cut hard to another scene. It doesn't work for me. It feels like it's too fast. We almost need that breather. It's not like they're going to another line of dialogue and you can't get past the laughs they would have had in the theater and then hear what's being said. We talked about that in Annie Hall when Woody Allen sneezes away the cocaine. They had to add padding in there. Mm-hmm. And An Airplane made the best example of this of all time. The sequence where the kid's talking to Peter Graves in the cockpit. You ever seen a grown man naked? And the kid looks almost at the camera, but he delays for so long. And it's because they had to make room for people laughing when they did the previews. They realized they're going to miss the next couple lines of dialogue. Tootsie doesn't edit it that way. It doesn't really work for me. You know what I'm saying? That it's almost like, here's a stinger, bang, to the next scene. It's almost too abrupt.
Kind of sitcom-y.
Although, maybe that's it, yeah.
That being said, a lot of sitcoms will actually leave far too much room for
they're too
laugh
loose,
tracks.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so maybe that's not right. But that was a criticism of the film, that it felt like a sitcom premise drawn out for 90
yes,
minutes.
Or, like I said, a 30s zany rom-com.
Yeah.
Screwball comedy, for sure. This is harkening back to that, as did some
definitely.
Like It Hot. To the few comedies we've had in the last little while. And we only have one true legitimate comedy left. We only have 18 more movies anyway. Fargo is the last one you could call an actual comedy.
That's debatable, too. It's a tragic comedy, I think, as they called it.
Yeah, it's a police story. It's a crime movie, sure. Forrest Gump and Pulp Fiction are very funny, but mm-hmm. not actual comedies.
And just while we're on the topic of comedies, Airplane is a movie that should be on the list. Not just of the funniest movies. It should be on the top 100 list, I'm saying it. It is funnier than a lot of the comedies that they did pick for the list.
Oh, that's definitely true. Well, that was certainly on the top 100 laughs list. But I mentioned Sidney Pollack and how he said they didn't make the movie a comedy on the set. It would have come across like a drama. The most famous thing to come out of this movie, apart from the film itself, I guess, would be the stories that Dustin Hoffman and Sidney Pollack's on-screen fights, where Pollack plays his agent and Hoffman plays a struggling actor, were based on what they actually went through when they made the movie. Because Hoffman is Mr. Difficult. Edward Norton, I think, seems to revere Dustin Hoffman above any actor. Certainly one of his favorite actors. And isn't that fitting? Because it seems to be that Edward Norton is Mr. Difficult and hard to work with. I respect that actors are more intelligent than anyone else they're working with, the director, the studio, or whomever. But sometimes you gotta just shut up and do your job. Yeah. If you're Dustin Hoffman and have that much clout at that point, 1982... you probably can get whatever you want.
If you want to be the boss, be the boss. Direct your own films. If you're going to work for a director, you have to defer to them, mm-hmm. eventually.
If that did aid those scenes of him battling with his agent, then it helped the movie. They're critical to the film, for sure. And Sidney Pollack proves what's been said by people smarter than I. He was a pretty good director, not one of my favorites by any means, but he was a better actor than he was a director.
Mm-hmm.
If you've seen him in movies like Eyes Wide Shut, and all kinds of cameos he's made, sometimes bigger performances than just that, he was really good in Changing Lanes with Ben Affleck. So here's a guy with one AFI film, Pollock. He did The Way We Were Before This, which was a massive hit with Redford and Streisand. And then he won the Oscar 3 years after this for Out of Africa with Redford again and Meryl Streep. I've not seen that movie any more than once. I probably never will see it again. But that was a big success as well. But in his career, he made a lot of movies I was not a big fan of. But what do you think of him as an actor in this film and the other ones you've probably seen? His direction in this film and other ones in general. Are you a fan of his?
I don't think I've seen enough of his films to say whether or not I'm a fan as an actor. I like him as an actor, but it's not as if his part here is all that integral or all that even well drawn. It's good. He's got that kind of dry way about him. He's caustic, and they have a great rapport with each other, and the way he's just so blatantly honest with him, it plays for comedy.
That's why I think he's critical.
Yeah, they wind up being cute scenes. as a director, it's hard to say. The film's obviously a real team effort because you've got plenty of screenwriters. Dustin Hoffman is clearly contributing a great deal. There was a lot of improv on set. Terry Garr takes credit for some of the funniest scenes, including her breaking out of the bathroom after being stuck in there for 30 minutes. Or you've got Bill Murray, who's obviously a famous...
He was improvising.
Yeah, yeah.
As he often does.
So you have a collaborative effort, and sometimes just managing a collaborative effort is a talent in and of itself. So being able to do something like that can be a gift and make you a good director. But the film has a strange direction that it takes, and like I've complained earlier, the plot is not all that convincing.
And the movie's too long. It's nearly two full
hours. Yeah, that's a good point, too. It kind of goes on not a beat.
The reason I ask you is because Sidney Pollack is not as famous or as talented as Mike Nichols is, but when we covered The Graduate and Virginia Woolf before that, which we liked a lot more than The Graduate, I said then the blasphemous statement that Mike Nichols was overrated, that he made those two great films, one of which we didn't even like as much as the other one, but he's thought of as one of the great directors of all time, and I don't think that he is. And I think Sidney Pollack is about that level, but a little less than him. There are a lot of mediocre directors. John Sturges is never thought of as one of the great directors of all time. More of a Western war kind of guy. I like his work way more.
Well, I'll say this for Mike Nichols in The Graduate. As much as you and I had real problems with the film, there were individual scenes that were played out so brilliantly, and every frame could have been a photograph and conveyed so much depth and beauty, and that's not necessarily something you see in Tootsie.
And that movie's way more influential than this one is, without a doubt. I say it's screwball comedy, going all the way back to 30s and 40s type movies. There's gay angles, lesbian angles. You get a woman falling for an older woman, because Julie does very sort of fall for Dorothy. She's definitely interested in her, and she doesn't seem to know what her own feelings are about this before she knows that it's actually Michael underneath that makeup. Michael, there's that name again. We've had that name a lot in this project, especially lately. Michael from The Godfather, Michael from The Deer Hunter. There are other examples I can't think of right this minute, but there's a lot of Michaels on this project. But getting back to the gay lesbian thing, then you get the older man, Charles Durning's Les, falling for a younger man, playing a woman. And that's one of the scenes that Hoffman has with Pollack, where he's explaining that whole thing. It isn't really all that funny, but it explains the plot and the way he's in this big pickle. How do I get out of this? And of course, he's actually got a contract on the show itself, so he's got to play Dorothy anyway.
You know, for a movie that repeats the point over and over again that Dorothy's homeliness is a handicap and how important it is to be attractive if you're a woman, she sure gets a lot of attention from men, because it's not just Les. Julie is at least attracted enough to her, despite being such a total catch.
Yeah.
But also the
George
actor...
George Gaines.
Who tries to rape her in her apartment.
Commandant Lazar from the Police Academy movies would be the most famous thing that guy ever did, I would say. He's quite lecherous as the doctor from the soap opera. And yeah, that's pretty offensive. Now, this movie, though, you could argue, especially for 1982, probably not for 2015, was a feminist film, and that is rare for the AFI Top 100. But there is sexism, there is abuse in some of the hospital scenes, and in that sequence where George Gaines is trying to take what he shouldn't be trying to get from Dustin Hoffman dressed as this lady.
I will take that argument and argue that this is not a feminist film. I think it's paying cute attention to feminist causes.
Is it trying to be?
It's trying to be, and even saying that, its heart is in the right place, but you have mostly men screenwriters, all male producers, a male director, a male star, all having their take on feminism, and it boils down to a man has to dress as a woman and be a better woman than any of the women in the film, then become their white knight. Because as much as it's his growth, although does he even grow? What does he learn in the film? He kind of sees a bit of the struggles that women go through and then mans all over them and wins at life while the women get nothing. There's no real progress even suggested.
He does have that line at the very end when he's himself speaking to Julie when she finally knows the big ruse. I was a better man with you as a woman than I ever was with a woman as a man. You know what I mean?
So then the suggestion in that is at the very least a compliment that being a woman and wearing that dress and behaving as a woman probably made him personally realize that he was being a jerk. Because he is a jerk. He never stops really being a jerk.
Remember we talked about the AFI special, Hoffman said that he himself wouldn't talk to a woman who looked like Dorothy.
Yeah.
In the party scene, in that enormous hangar of an apartment that he and Jeff, Bill Murray's character, have. What is Jeff's full name in this movie?
Come on.
They say it. Jeff Slater.
All right.
Jeff Slater. But the apartment that they share, enormous, they have the birthday party for Michael. And what is he doing in that sequence? The only women he is talking to are good-looking, younger women.
Part of that is because they have to aggressively prove the point over and over again that he's masculine. A heterosexual, you guys. He's not gay. He's not doing it because he's gay. Look, do you need proof? Do you need to see him sleep with his friend for the dumbest possible reason? And this is my problem with it. He's so cruel, really, to Sandy. And he never stops being cruel to her. And the conclusion of that story is just that she disappears.
We see her name on a marquee where she's in the play that they're finally going to make.
Oh, that's true.
So I guess they made up enough for her to be in the play. Or she's wanted the part bad enough that she'll say, I hate your guts, but I'll work with you.
Or she's enough of a doormat, which she is. Mm-hmm. All the women are. And even Julie to some extent, because, I mean, Julie is that typical
Dabney Coleman is debatably taking advantage of her.
Oh, debatably. He's like a cartoonish villain.
He may have actually gotten into her pants in the first place because he's her boss.
Yeah, he's such a bad guy. And this is another thing with this, is he's such an outrageous bad guy that you can't expect anybody to remotely empathize and see themselves in him. He's just the terrible, sexist, misogynist director.
This is what Dabney Coleman was good at back in the 80s, though. 9 to 5, he was the villain in that film. He often played villains. He worked with Pollock quite a bit, in fact. And then War Games as well. He's the sort of villain, the antagonist versus Matthew Broderick. And he plays it well, but I don't know if it's written all that well because it is a little bit too on the nose.
Yeah.
And Michael sees the way he treats Julie early on, not quite beaten to death, that this is not good for her. This is not good for her, flashing neon sign kind of thing. But you can see that Michael realizes, well, not only do I want her, he shouldn't have her.
But here's a great contradiction in the film. The only reason he cares about Julie's welfare is because he's physically attracted to her. Mm-hmm. The second he lays eyes on her, he sees that she's beautiful, he cares about what happens to her, and then she's dating this total ridiculous mustache-twirling monster.
Who's also been hard on him and his Dorothy guys.
Yeah, so he has to rescue her. She has really very little personality to speak of other than she's sweet and she's demure and she's beautiful. And she has this perfect life, this perfect dad and farm and child. She serves no purpose other than to be Michael's reward for having this little iota of growth. And this is such a typical sexist Hollywood trope that women are only there to provide a reward for the male protagonist, their trophy for whatever they're supposed to achieve. They get to kiss the girl at the end, which he does. So,
Hang on a second. I have a point to make about that. This is a romance with almost no physical contact of a romantic or sexual nature, not including things like the attempted rape. Does he ever kiss Julie?
Well,
as Michael.
He sleeps with Sandy.
Well, we don't see that.
No, we don't see it, but we definitely know that happens.
But the main love story is Hoffman and Lang, and they don't have any on-screen romance.
And but
when
that
he's dressed
be
as Dorothy, it gets close to being that because they almost kiss.
That could be part of the whole homosexual panic. They are so aggressively trying to stop anybody from thinking that this was anything but a very straight film.
But I bring it up because you're talking about the kiss. Movies like this usually end with a kiss on the lips. Mm-hmm. Some Like It Hot did, at least with Tony Curtis and Marilyn Monroe. And when she learns the ruse, she has forgiven him. Julie forgives Michael maybe a little bit too easily because he was lying to her.
Yeah, he doesn't even really properly apologize to her. If you pay attention to that scene, he's just like, oh, I just had to do what I had to do. You don't understand. But he never says to her, I'm sorry for this elaborate deception that wound up with her confessing all kinds of things to him that she wouldn't have said if he was a man, sharing a bed with her.
Yeah.
All kinds of things that could easily be understood as a betrayal. Not to mention, her father falls in love with Dorothy for some reason. It maybe didn't break his heart, but it certainly humiliated him.
Yeah. The sequence that Hoffman has with Durning is probably more effective than the one he has with Lang, which is right after
it's an actual apology when he apologizes to her dad, to Les.
And gives the ring back.
You know, when you boil it down, the message of Tootsie, while it means well, is that even a very flawed man is better at being a woman than women are. It reminded me of The Help, which was overwhelmingly popular with white women, but got a lot of really well-deserved criticism from black people for being condescending and so self-satisfied. I think that Tootsie kind of deserves the same criticism. Terry Garr, I found this amazing interview with her on AV Club, which I think we should link to. They asked her if she thought it was a feminist film, and she's like, no, of course not, because she does not care about anything anymore, and she's just, like, speaking her mind in the most amazing way. This interview's amazing. And she said, I think that what Dustin Hoffman says is, I realize how important it is for a woman to be pretty, and I wasn't pretty. God, that's all you realize? Jesus Christ. Oh, well. Don't quote me. Actually, quote me. I love her now. I couldn't believe it.
As funny as I think that is, and probably true, she is talking about a movie that was made 33 years ago. It reminds me of Rocky. You said a sequence when Rocky first seduces Adrian is borderline coercion, maybe even leaning towards rape. And we had to agree in the end that made by male studio people, made by male filmmakers, this was an attempt to show a person being sensitive. And you said on that podcast that from that point on, Rocky's a great boyfriend and is always stuck behind her and doesn't do anything else you could possibly call offensive towards Adrian. Tootsie's arguably the same thing. Hoffman, Pollock, and everybody involved in the film are trying their best to do something that they're just not going to understand.
Yes.
Not that I'm letting them off the hook. But I can relate to them more than you can, because I've had to even learn some lessons in recent years about things I may have said. I don't think I was a sexist person, but now compared to the way I was a few years ago, I probably was.
You know, we all have to grow and learn, and it's a process for each and every one of us. I think what something like this shows is just that we need to include more voices in Hollywood that aren't white men. Then a movie like this would be about one person's journey and wouldn't be forced to stand in for sexism and feminism in general, because that's a real absurdity that this is the best voice they could come up with at the time. So maybe include more voices.
Yeah. Okay, let's get off the political soapbox, although it was a fair point to make, and I'm glad you made it. It had to be made. But let's talk about the actual drag, because the first time we see Michael as Dorothy, just bang! He's on the street in full Dorothy costume, not in Dorothy 1.0. Right away, it's the look he's going to have the rest of the film.
Yeah.
Contrast to the movie that would definitely be inspired by this one, Robin Williams' Crown and Achievement, or one of them anyway, Mrs. Doubtfire, where we see this long sequence where he and his brother and the brother's boyfriend are dressing him up. They're putting on makeup, all that stuff to make him into be Mrs. Doubtfire. We see two or three different outfits that he has, and that's a whole big comedy sequence.
In Tootsie, they spare us that by just showing the montage of him applying a totally different makeup.
A little later on, though, yes.
Yeah, okay, yeah. To show to us he knows how to do this so that they don't need to show that scene.
Actors wear makeup all the time. Anyway, if you're a stage actor, generally you put your own makeup on. Is it really all that different to do this? It's way more prep. You have to shave your legs. They show him getting up really early in the morning to do that and plucking eyebrows. That's more than a man would typically do for a man role. But putting on makeup, wearing wigs, wearing different kinds of costumes, something you do anyway, especially if you're a stage actor. When in costume and makeup, Dustin Hoffman could fool people.
Yep.
The story Midnight Cowboy is, he had been in The Graduate, wanted to play Ratso Rizzo. The producers didn't think he could pull it off. He dressed as Ratso, was on a New York street corner. The producer walked by and he, hey buddy, can you spare some change? And the guy sloughed him off. And then when he walked away, Hoffman chased after him and said, hey, it's me, it's me. Oh, wait a minute, maybe you can play Ratso Rizzo.
Oh, wow.
To prepare for this movie, he dressed as Dorothy and fooled his daughter's teachers.
Wow.
Maybe they didn't know Dustin Hoffman all that well. Maybe he wasn't at a lot of PTA meetings in the first place. But that says something.
He doesn't make a pretty woman, as we've pointed out many times. But he does have a very womanly figure. He's a petite guy.
He's short,
and he's small, and he has a small waist. So when he's in those dresses, he has like a woman's figure.
Convincing enough, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he has to wear glasses, which was done partly to hide the nose. I don't know if it really hides it, but to de-accentuate his big nose and make him look more feminine, which is the opposite of Superman. This is effectively his Superman role of all time, just like Mrs. Doubtfire is for the Robin Williams character in that film. That's probably the crowning achievement that those two actors within the stories will ever have, the ones that make them famous anyway. But it's the opposite in the Superman story, where wearing the glasses is the weak character, not the stronger version of you. And as far as this acting challenge, because that's what Dorothy is for him, any actor, and you talk about how actors would have voted for this film because they can relate to it so much, this is the epitome of rejection frustrations. He only goes out for this role because Sandy doesn't get it, she doesn't look anything like what they want, and then he realizes somewhere in there, that's my part. The ultimate in feeling that rejection and being, as we said at the beginning, desperate enough to try anything.
Yeah, they really drive home that unemployment is a massive problem for him. This is like an economic choice that he makes.
And he also finds out that context is everything in pickup lines. Julie says to him when he's in his Dorothy outfit, what if some guy just came up to me and said, I find you really interesting, I'd like to get to know you better, and I'd like to sleep with you, something along those lines. Then in the middle of the movie, he's dressed as himself at some party, he walks up to her, says that, gets a drink in his face. There's a part of me, maybe this is the non-feminist side of me, that felt like, that is not fair, you literally said that would work. And she slapped him, and she threw a drink right in his face.
Okay, here's what I have to say to that, to defend the woman. One, that's just dumb girl talk. Girls say that stuff to each other. And two, when people say things like that, what they mean is they want a man that they would be interested in sleeping with.
Of course.
To say that to them. They don't want Dustin Hoffman to come up and say that to them. For a comparison, from the men's point of view, all those men who say, I would love to be catcalled, well, they would love to be catcalled, because in their imagination, it's always going to be somebody who looks like Jessica Lange, telling them that they look
not
great in those tight
like
pants.
Not like Dorothy Michaels.
Exactly. So that is my response to that, because it is a funny scene, and you see it coming a mile away, because you know nobody's ever going to get away with talking to a woman like that, except somebody very sexy.
All right, so Michael's big reveal in the soap opera. when he outs himself on live television, which is a pretty smart thing to do to get out of this contract. But it's implied in the movie as if maybe his run is over. Maybe his career is going to be over. How did you deceive us? Michael in 2015 would get so much work after that big reveal. He'd be the biggest star in the world. He'd be a way bigger star than they show him as a soap opera actress early in the film where he's on all these covers of magazines.
Or would he get the Rachel Dolezal treatment?
No, I think he would be outed as a fraud and that would make him so much more money.
He was on the cover of Ms. Magazine when they believed that he was a woman. That is not a star, that's a fraud.
Our culture would revere that person. I was thinking that all through that sequence because I knew, of course, it was coming. I've seen the movie more than once. And I thought, this guy would not have a career that was over from that point on. He'd be bigger than ever.
He would definitely get a reality show out of it.
Well, they do make the play. He gets enough money from playing Dorothy for all those months to finally get Jeff's playmate. So I guess there's that happy ending. That's the whole thrust of this in the first place, is he just wants to make money to get that one playmate. He even says so in the beginning. And also his "I'm a man" improv on the soap opera is commonplace on those shows now. I don't know when that all started, the amnesia angles you always have in soap operas, or you're a man playing a woman playing a man, your twin brothers, twin sisters, all those kinds of angles that they put in soap operas all the time. But if it wasn't before 1982, it's absolutely regular ever since. I've not watched a soap opera in a long time, but I used to watch them with my mom and my sister.
Yeah, I think the fake identity thing has always been a pretty common trope in soap operas.
Okay, Dustin Hoffman's final AFI film. Peter Sellers and Michael Caine were bandied about for the role. Sellers would have been great because he was always great. And Michael Caine's a good actor. I don't think he could have pulled off this role as well as Dustin did. And you didn't even think that Dustin Hoffman was all that great. Did you notice that Michael's man outfit, he tends to wear the same kinds of clothes, is very similar to how De Niro is dressed in Taxi Driver, the jeans and the green jacket?
Well, I noticed that because you pointed it out to me while we were watching the movie. Do you think maybe that was something that became trendy in the 80s?
I think it may have been. I remember the story Paul Schrader said that when Taxi Driver came out and it was a surprise success at the box office, that a lot of guys in the lineups were dressed just like Bickle does in the movie.
I have to confess that I'm pretty sure there was a day this week when I was wearing an outfit that you would have described as a Travis Bickle outfit. I have a green fatigue jacket and a beat up pair of
boots. You did wear that this week. That's right. That's true. All right, so because this is his last film, and I've said so many great things about him in the previous movies, and yet I haven't loved two of them, and maybe even three of them. Midnight Cowboy I like more than you did, but not one of my favorites. But The Graduate, Midnight Cowboy, All the President's Men, and Tootsie. We got two from the 60s, one from the middle of the 70s, one from the early 80s. For the most part, successful, rewarded, all that stuff. Four AFI films is nothing to sneeze at. He's the lead in all of them as well. Harrison Ford has five. He's only the lead in arguably two of them, Raiders and Blade Runner.
Duvall has six.
But always a supporting character. Ward Bond is an even lower build than Duvall. He's a much smaller supporting character. What is your favorite of his four AFI films, though?
I've liked all of them, but my favorite is definitely All the President's Men.
Mm-hmm. And as I said, he's not even the main thrust in that. It's more Redford and the ensemble cast in general.
Mm-hmm.
All right, enough about Dusty. Jessica Lange. She was in Francis this same year. She was nominated for the Oscar for Best Actress. But next week's movie, Sophie's Choice, Meryl Streep's movie, everyone knew that she was going to win the Oscar for that one. So it's been said that Lange won the Supporting Actress Oscar in this movie as a consolation prize.
Well, that would explain, because I saw that she won, and I was just confounded.
And she was up against Terry Garr from this movie.
Because Terry Garr's performance is, at the very least, she's an interesting character, where Jessica Lange is so banal. There's nothing to her.
She is pretty paper thin, it's true. But she's not so paper thin in movies like Cape Fear and American Horror Story. She was in the King Kong movie 1976, the remake, where they made Kong a sympathetic character, which was a nice turn on that. It wasn't that the Dwan, they called her that, such a dumb thing, name should have been Dawn, isn't afraid of Kong. And then we talked on the King Kong podcast about how great it was, Naomi Watts' performance in the newer one, where she's very sympathetic towards him. And the version that Lang did started that trend. American Horror Story, we've only seen season one of that. We didn't like it, although she's the best thing in that. I've heard that she has remained the best thing in that in all the various iterations of characters she's played.
She would be the only thing to make it worth watching, and she is so fantastic. She eats scenery like crazy, but every scene she's in is better than
much like modern Jane Fonda does.
Love it.
Things like The Newsroom. Terry Garr was in Young Frankenstein, very funny performance, and then, of course, in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, an AFI film that we covered a few weeks ago. She's likable, but I do think she's a bit shticky and a bit shrill in this movie.
We all know people like her, needy and paranoid. People like her aren't really nice to be around. So it's funny when it's played for comedy, but you're right. She's, I wouldn't call her shrill, but definitely annoying.
Well, desperate actors probably are a bit annoying because they would be even more focused on their careers than successful ones would be, you'd think. You could get to a certain amount of comfort if you are successful, even if it's only for a 6-month run on Broadway or something.
If Sandy was a real person, as opposed to a character, her and Marc Maron could just sit down and hash out all of their crazy anxieties for days.
Yeah. Charles Durning. We covered him in Dog Day Afternoon when we did that from the Not 100 Project. That was a great performance and underrated. And the same year as this, Bachelor of Horrors in Texas came out in 1982. He got nominated for Best Supporting Actor for that. And as I've said in other movies before, I'm sure part of that was a compilation. You're rewarded for more than one performance. And he doesn't have a big role in this movie, but he's pretty good. I wouldn't say it's critical. It is kind of an unnecessary sidebar. Maybe that's what pumps up the running time to nearly 2 hours. But as we said, the Hoffman and Durning scene towards the end is a pretty effective, I'm sorry, I forgive you type moment.
Him falling in love with Dorothy is the least believable thing that happens in the movie,
though. One of the most least believable things we've seen in the entire project so far,
yeah.
I would say.
Yeah, outside of Swing Time.
Dabney Coleman, we talked about some of his credits already. He's been working for 50-plus years and is still going, and he does play slimes as well as anybody. Bill Murray, who's unbilled in the film and his only AFI performance. We did cover him in Groundhog Day on the Not 100 Project earlier this year. And we're probably going to do some other films in the future that he was in. Surely. When this project's done, Ghostbusters 1 will undoubtedly do. I read that he was unbilled because he and the producers didn't want people to think it was another Stripes, Meatballs, Bill Murray kind of movie, because he is a secondary, maybe even a third or fourth or fifth level character.
Yeah, he never seems really fussed about getting credit for films. I mean, look at his Wes Anderson stuff or his cameo that he did in Zombieland. He's okay with being the surprise player and not getting his name on posters or dumb stuff like
that. He steals Kingpin. I like that movie a lot. It's very funny. But he's the best thing in that movie by a country mile.
He has the best line in Tootsie, too.
That is one nutty hospital.
Oh, my God.
Gina Davis. This is her first film, and she didn't make another one until 1985. I don't know why. She's pretty good. She's very cute. She's in her underwear a few times in the movie. And she won an Oscar in 1988 for The Accidental Tourist.
Oh, yeah.
So she had a career pretty fast once she finally got going in the mid-80s.
And that gives me an opportunity to go back and take back something I said in last week's podcast about Blade Runner, where I was totally trashing on Ridley Scott, and I completely forgot that he made an excellent film, Thelma and Louise, so I do love one of his films starring Gina Davis, The Wonderful. So I take back my total trashing of Ridley Scott last
week. And as good as Susan Sarandon is in that film, Davis's arc is fantastic. She goes from the battered housewife, and she's cute, and she's nice, and she's sweet, to being a legitimate badass, with still definitely a heart of gold.
God, that is a great movie.
I just saw that movie a few months ago, and it has held up pretty damn well. And here's an actor that I'm sure you didn't see in the movie, and neither did I, because I forgot to look for him, but he is in the credits on the IMDb, Tobin Bell, Jigsaw from the Saw movies.
Oh, okay.
This was also his first film. He's uncredited. And I bring him up because he's going to be in another AFI film, unlike Bill Murray, for example, and that's another tiny role as the parole officer in Goodfellas. That's a huge cast. We may not mention him on that movie. We might forget to, because there's so many actors to talk about when we get to Goodfellas. But there's Tobin Bell. We talked a lot about Sidney Pollack already. He was a triple threat, directing, producing, along with Dick Richards, and then, of course, acting as the agent George Fields. Hal Ashby and Dick Richards, one of the producers, were set to direct before Pollack took it on. Ashby was doing some other movie and it got delayed. That's why he didn't keep the role. But that would have been interesting because Ashby worked with good actors often and he sometimes brought out their best performances. There are several writers in this film. Larry Gelbart is the most famous one. He wrote for the MASH TV show. Murray Shishkal, I think is how you say his name, and Don McGuire also have story credit on the film. And Elaine May was uncredited. We talked earlier about Mike Nichols. Well, there is his old writing partner, Elaine May, doing some work behind the scenes. Gelbart has long been bothered by Hoffman cutting him and others out of the credit for this picture. When Hoffman was on Inside the Actor's Studio, which was also a terrific moment for him, a two-hour special, he was great in that one. But I guess Hoffman's kind of just said, it was my movie and I did everything kind of thing. I've never really actually heard Dustin Hoffman say that, so maybe it's been behind-the-scenes kind of stuff. But Gelbart said that he was cut out of way too much of the credit for it.
The Writers Guild had to settle a dispute about who got credit for Tootsie.
That tells you a lot, then. Hoffman, I remember, said in the making of Kramer vs. Kramer that he could have gotten a nomination, or there would have been a win, as it turns out, for writing, because he helped them write it. And Robert Benton, the director and one of the writers, would have had no problem with that. But Hoffman just said, no, it's fine, I don't need that.
But we've said this so many times, directors and actors probably do deserve at least a little credit in people's minds for
writing.
Yeah, because they so frequently are going to alter things or improvise.
Bill Murray in this movie arguably could have gotten credit for that. And we said on Raging Bull a few weeks ago that De Niro and Scorsese went into St. Bart's and rewrote half the screenplay, maybe the whole screenplay, and yet get no writing credit. All right, technically, the movie is 2-3-5-1, and this is the first time we've ever said this. We saw it on demand. Luckily, we were able to find it that way. This is the last movie that we don't own in one form or another on our shelves. It looked pretty good. The cinematographer, Owen Roisman, who did The French Connection and Network, he also, of course, shot The Exorcist, which may be the best looking of all those pictures. You said it looked like a sitcom, but a lot of people in the reviews were saying that the movie looks fantastic. Maybe they meant the quality of the Blu-ray or the DVD.
I didn't say it looks like a sitcom. It just kind of has a sitcom premise.
Oh, plays like a sitcom.
Yeah, okay. But I wouldn't call it a beautiful-looking film. I don't think it's visually inspired all that much.
And another New York film. We've had so many of them, but not really so many that lasted a while. I guess Raging Bull, but that's also a period New York film. And not that many scenes in the street in either this or Raging Bull. The editors, Frederick and William Steinkamp, they're a father and son team, and they worked a lot with Sidney Pollack. And I said already, I was not a big fan of some of the edits in this film. Never have been. And the composer, Dave Grusin, who did do some work on The Graduate, that movie technically doesn't have a composer, but he's involved in some way in that. And he was also involved in Reds and did a ton of TV.
Do you like the song, the famous song?
It Might Be You. Well, when I was doing my pre-search on this and wrote that as a top 100 song nominee for the list, I didn't even recognize what the hell it was.
You know the song, though.
I do now. I've seen the movie, yes.
Oh, really? I feel like it's this big, bad, easy listening staple. Something that would have come on the radio in my parents' car when
I was a kid. Did you recognize when you heard it as a song?
Yeah, it was a radio hit, that song. Okay. Something's telling me it might be lame.
Okay, influence. It's influenced by Some Like It Hot, as we said, and it influenced Mrs. Doubtfire. Those three films would be an interesting little triple header. And those zany 30s rom-coms.
It was also influenced by La Cage aux Folles, which Hoffman said he studied when he took the part.
And that was made into The Birdcage in the mid-90s with Robin Williams.
Robin Williams.
In a lesser role, not doing the over-the-top role that...
Nathan Lane.
...had. Right. One more thing about Mrs. Doubtfire and Tootsie. Right down to getting a TV job because of the older woman getup. Spoiler alert for Mrs. Doubtfire, but I think most people have seen that film. Towards the end, that's how he gets a job, because he dresses up like that and has some hijinks in a restaurant. And, of course, that's the whole premise of Tootsie. His shopping spree when he goes out looking for clothes, I guess you could say his homage is in Pretty Woman. This would be, oh, ugly woman, walking down the street, ugly woman. One of the other things he says in the FI special, like I said, it's a huge chunk of time in that, that the makeup people said, that's as good looking as we can get you, Charlie.
Don't play hard to get. Great line. Another great line. Bill Murray.
And here's a weird comparison. Won't make sense until a second from now when I finish this point. But Batman. Do women fall for the outward, quote-unquote, suit or the person inside? Julie is falling for the suit. I mean, she's not literally lesbian. I'm not saying that. But he, as Michael, she doesn't like him at first. And when she meets him at the end, she doesn't seem to... Well, she's forgiving him, I guess. But she's not really all that into him. It's more like, well, we can be buddies. Let's hug on the street. We're not going to kiss. So there you go, the Batman thing. Is it more about the suit or the person inside?
There were radically different suits that you're describing here.
What do you say? I could get a job in a soap if I wanted to. Because I'm Batman. Okay, let's go to the awards section. So it won the one Oscar for Supporting Actress, the Consolation Prize. 9 nominations that did not win. Best Picture, Best Director, both of those were won by Gandhi. Best Actor, also won by Gandhi, Ben Kingsley. That was a good category that year. Paul Newman was nominated for The Verdict, and Jack Lemmon for Missing, and I'm forgetting the 5th nominee at the moment, but Kingsley won out over all of them. Gar for Supporting Actress, losing to her co-star. The Screenplay, The Editing, The Cinematography, The Sound, and It Might Be You for Best Song. Tootsie made the National Film Registry in 1998, and the only other AFI recognition was it was 2nd on the top 100 laughs. Not right or fair. It was nominated for 2 other lists. The top 100 quotes was, that sequence where the producer says, I want to make her look a little better. How far can you pull back? And the answer is, and this is the quote, how do you feel about Cleveland? And then it might be for top 100 songs.
So never nominated for quote was, I was a better man with you as a woman than I ever was with a woman as a man?
I don't think so. I looked through and I didn't find
that one. I'm surprised. That seems to be the most famous line from that movie.
As we said, the songs and quotes lists are bogus, as is the comedy list. All right, well, as for the main AFI Top 100 list, this film's been in the 60s both times. We wouldn't put it there. We said that already. What are your parting thoughts on Tootsie?
If it was just a movie, I wouldn't be dumping all over it like this, but the idea that it's consistently being considered one of the best movies made in Hollywood forces me to point out that it's plain not.
And 6 or 8 laughs in a 2-hour comedy. Just not enough.
Yeah, some good laughs, but when there's so many funnier films that have been left off the list over and over again, forget it. No.
In the execution of the premise, being sexist doesn't help either.
Like I said, their heart's in the right place. It was 1982, and it's really only sexist because people tried to frame it as a feminist movie, which it's really not.
All right. Well, I haven't had that in my notes, so there you go. I'm trying not to be a sexist person, and even I'm making a sexist point if I said that.
I'm so sorry.
I'm just going to educate you.
I'm a better man with you as a woman than I was as a woman, as a man with a man, as a woman, as a whatever, whatever.
Just continue to, you know, listen to everything I tell you, and I will make you a progressive man.
Be nothing like a woman dressed like a boring old 40-year-old guy. 41-year-old guy. I'd never get work in Hollywood at that age. All right, enough of that. So up next on the Top Under Project is a hard left into bipolarism and the Holocaust. Yay, fun! I told you there are more comedies on the list. It's Meryl Streep in arguably her signature role, Sophie's Choice. The coming attractions trivia. Including Sophie's Choice, there are 18 films remaining on the Top 100 Project. Other than Sophie's Choice, what are the only movies that didn't score a Best Picture Oscar nomination?
Ooh, good question. Okay, so for the answer to that, please tune into next week's podcast. If you'd like more from Ryan and me, like more trivia and links to some of the things that we talked about in today's podcast, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. And if you'd like to reach us personally, go ahead and send us an email. We'd love to hear from you guys. Our address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. And before we leave you, we have to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Would Anne Bancroft and The Graduate go after this version of Dustin Hoffman? No!
Something's telling me it wouldn't be him. And cut.